Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to all the men and women who have served and are currently serving as carrier folks right in the U.S. Navy.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you're going to be listening on today's Veterans Radio program. We're coming live. That's right, we're live. None of that pre-recorded stuff, just as it comes through the airways, live right on WDEO, part of the Ave Maria Network, or on WDEO AM. And if you want to listen to us, yes, with a little bit of clarity, and you're going to want to go to our website, www.veteransradio.net. Be sure it's .net. So that's veteransradio.net. Click on all those links and all that other business, and you'll be able to hear us live, or go to our archives. Give us just a couple of hours after the program's been completed, and we'll be on the archive. You'll be able to hear it there, or you can even make a recording, play it in your car radio. Isn't that kind of cool? So as I'm looking over here at the Admiral, well, we can't talk to him for just a moment, but he was stuck in traffic, and if he had a Veterans Radio archive, well, he'd be able to keep right up to date. He's got a big smile on his face. That's good. We got a program today. I love aircraft carriers. I don't know what it is about aircraft carriers, because there's very few of us that really have a whole lot of information. It's an island. It's a city block in the ocean. And it's got its own family and its own people. Everything there is self-contained. I want to know all about it. I have the Enterprise, that's right, CV-65. I had a captain, former captain of the Enterprise. Can you believe that? Well, was he going to have some stories? And a pilot who flew Tomcats. That's right, right off the Enterprise. Tomcats, they're going to tell us what a burble is. Yeah. Oh, and you know, this is all betting stuff, folks. So you're going to want to write this down, and then when you go to your favorite pub, you'll say, hey, I know what a burble is. Oh, yeah? Well, then you'll be able to tell them, because we're going to find all that information, all the little idiosyncrasies regarding the Enterprise. If you have any questions, or just a comment, doesn't have to be a question, it could be a comment, give us a call, it's free, 877-573-7825, that's right, if you didn't write that down, here we go again, 877-573-7825, and Nina has a gentleman on just before we get into the Enterprise, and, well, here we go, okay, sir, and what's your name? Well, can we connect him, Nina?
Bob, I'm going to go ahead and give him a call back. It looks like we have a technical difficulty.
Oh, you know, we've had a number of them this morning. One of our guests was stuck in bumper-to-bumper parking lot on I-94, and the other guest had family. I mean, it was just in my cell phone, Lord. So we're doing a whole lot, and it's like the gremlins are still left over from October the 31st. So, Nina, what do you say we go right into Marine Scholars? Okay, and we'll be right back. This is Veterans Radio. Come on back to the Big E.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu. Or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
still makes goosebumps boy, to hear that. I was just a little kid, and Sunday morning, I think it was on like 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the morning, black and white, and that big V would come in. Victory at Sea, Rodgers and Hammerstein. Wow, what a great way to start the program. Well, before I get in with my distinguished guest here in the studio, right now, somebody you're all familiar with, the military channel familiar with him, Discovery Channel, Barrett Tillman is an internationally recognized authority on World War II naval and aviation history. He's got 45 books to his credit, including 7 novels. He has received 7 awards for history and literature, frequently appears on television documentaries. Barrett Tillman, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, hello there, Bob. It's good to be back aboard.
Oh, it's good to have you. Well, back aboard. I guess that's very appropriate. Okay, I don't want to even say another thing about the Big E, the aircraft carrier, the first nuclear-powered carrier that we've had. It went out on its, well, supposedly to be final voyage. I believe it left in May. Isn't that right, Barrett? July or May?
March.
Oh, wow. Okay, even earlier than that. And it went to off station at the Middle East, and for a 7-month deployment, where is it right now?
As far as I know, she's inbound to Norfolk today.
Today?
Well, she's headed for Norfolk at present, and I think she's due to make port this week. That's my understanding.
Okay, now, all right, what's scheduled? Are all the planes off? First of all, right now, or do they come in to the port at New York? Do they come in, or is she going to Norfolk, or is she going to New York?
Norfolk.
Okay. When they come into Norfolk, are all the planes off?
They will fly off when they get within range.
Okay, so now they have, the ship is now coming in. It sounds like, well, is the port okay after the storm?
I assume that it is, but I haven't heard.
Okay, well then it must be ready to come on in. And what happens after that?
Well, the aircraft will fly into Naval Air Station Oceana, which is right nearby. And then Captain Hamilton, Boomer Hamilton, has already said that it's really a bittersweet sensation for him and the entire crew, because this the day that the ship is moored to the dock, that's probably the last time that grand old lady will ever move under her own power.
Well, that's sad. Where's it going to go from there?
Well, she's going to remain in Norfolk for decommissioning, and the Navy makes a distinction, and I think probably both your guests can explain it better than I can, but the ship will leave active service in December, the first week in December, and then some months later, she will formally be decommissioned and begin dismantling.
No, you don't mean the welding torch, the cutting torch, do you?
Yeah, that's that's the situation with any nuclear-powered vessel, and of course, Enterprise is the first nuclear aircraft carrier. Those 8 reactors that she has.
How many reactors?
She has 8 reactors, and in comparison to the present Nimitz class, I believe has 2. So that shows you the progress of nuclear propulsion from the early 1960s to today.
And why don't you tell our viewers a little bit of what that means? So there has to be yearly or every 2 years you have to change the fuel rods, or 6 months. What is that?
I don't recall how long it is between refuelings, but it's several years, and it's a lengthy, time-consuming process. I think the longest refueling that Enterprise had was about 4 years, although my recollection is that also included a refit, which is a Navalese for updates and improvements. So the only way to remove those reactors is to cut open the hull, and essentially the ship is going to be gutted to remove all of those reactors.
Well, I don't know. I have a problem with that. Folks, it's been 51 years in commission. I guess it's just too expensive to make it in. We already have one museum, correct? Isn't that correct, with an aircraft carrier there in New York?
Yeah, the Intrepid is in New York, but there's the Lexington, which is another World War II Essex-class ship in Galveston, one of her sisters. The Hornet is at Alameda in California. And then the Midway, which is the one of the first post-war carriers, is at San Diego. And there's talk of one of the Forrestal-class ships, the Saratoga, possibly being preserved, I think, in Portland, anyway, in the Northwest. So there are numerous aircraft carrier museums around the country.
So we don't necessarily need another one, even with one with a distinguishing name such as this.
Well, when you mention names and aircraft carriers, you immediately touch a nerve, because unfortunately, from my view as a purist, and it's a view shared by millions of people, the U.S. Navy long ago began naming its premier warships for mere politicians. And it's not just presidents. There have been two long-serving members of Congress. The Stennis and the Vinson have been honored with that names. And the most recent ones that have been designated by the Secretary of the Navy are the second, John F. Kennedy, the first one having left service about 6 or 7 years ago, and then the leadership of the new class of aircraft carriers is the Gerald Ford.
Okay, and there's just no room. So, well, she's a ghost, and no matter how well maintained, I guess after 50 years, did you hear that, Nina? 50 years, you're headed for the scrap heap. That's awful, but things have to be, then things have to be. And where's that going to be cut up again, at Norfolk, or is that going out to California?
No, as far as I know, the dismantling is going to be done entirely in Norfolk. And if I remember correctly from what Boomer Hamilton said early this year, the eight 1960s vintage reactors either will be sent cross country, or I think more likely they will be shipped around the tip of South America for final handling at the nuclear facility in Washington State, in Hanford, which is not far from where I grew up.
I want to ask you a question. Has the Enterprise ever gone through the Panama Canal?
I don't think so. I'm hard-pressed to remember if she ever has.
Too big?
Yeah.
Okay. Ooh. So you'd have to sail around South America. Whoa.
Yeah, Tierra del Fuego and all that area.
Del Fuego, the fire, correct?
Yeah.
Oy. That doesn't sound... That was like some more storms. Well, I want to thank you again for coming back on the program and setting the tone for the CVN 65. I want to remind all my folks and listeners out there, Christmas time is coming up. Hey, what do I buy? Well, for that veteran in your family, you're going to want to buy the book, The Big E. Barrett, why don't you tell us a little bit how they can receive their copy?
The title of my book, published early this year, is called Enterprise, America's Fightingest Ship and the Men Who Helped Win World War II. And it's the first-to-last story, a fabulous story of the first carrier Enterprise, CV-6, which was in commission from 1938 to 1946, and had more battle stars than any other ship in the U.S. Navy. That meant that she was engaged in almost every major naval action in the Pacific Ocean, from Pearl Harbor up into the last year of the war in 1945. And the book is usually available in bookstores such as Barnes & Noble, and it's also available off the Internet on Amazon.com.
And, of course, they can buy their copy, and that would make a veteran. Doesn't have to be Navy, folks. You might have anybody out there that wants a good read, a little bit on the history of aircraft carriers. I know that we'll kind of close with this, that the Enterprise, all the Enterprises, are very high on tradition. So the current Enterprise has five or six portholes from the CV-6. What's going to happen? Anybody know what they're going to say from the CVN-65?
The portholes from the original Enterprise, I believe, already are spoken for, and each of those will be going to various Navy or military museums around the country.
Is there any talk about making maybe not an aircraft carrier, but something else with the Enterprise name?
There's just been talk. As I was saying about the controversy over naming aircraft carriers for mere politicians, there was real hope among the World War II veterans that their beloved Big E CV-6 would have the name on the next ship in the Ford class, but unfortunately the Secretary of the Navy decided to designate another John F. Kennedy, and the universal opinion among the World War II Big E sailors, in my experience, is that that name belongs on an aircraft carrier rather than something else, and they would just rather see it go away rather than be bestowed upon what they consider a lesser ship.
Well, I would think a letter-writing campaign to the Secretary of Navy would be a good idea to get. Thumbs up by both of my in-studio guests. I guess that's a good idea, folks. Coming from an Army guy, not too bad. No, I have no sea legs. None. Let's forget about that. Okay, thank you very much, Barrett Tillman, author of The Big E, the story of the Enterprise. You can get that at Barnes & Noble or just going on Amazon.com. Barrett, thank you very much. We're going to have you on the program again for our Christmas show, where we tell all my listeners about gifts for that veteran. Barrett, thank you again, and have yourself a great day.
Thank you, my friend.
Okay, Chauncey, let's go to a PSA. We got it right now. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Check it out. It's the Terminator. Hey, when'd you get back, huh?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Why are you being so jumpy? Put all that stuff behind you, okay?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org because we know where you're coming from. Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio, and after that PSA, today's program is going to be about the Big E. We had Barrett Tillman on the first part. Now I have in my studio, we pulled this thing off, folks, and it shows what an airborne paratrooper, a Tomcat pilot, and can you believe, right here, across from me, I've waited a long time to have a captain of a ship, and the ship is an aircraft carrier, and is the aircraft carrier that we're going to be talking about today. And with me in the studio is our pilot, Commander Chris Gordon, Ann Arbor, Michigan. He's retired, but, let me get... I think I can read his bio right now. Here we go. Chris Gordon, commissioned through the Naval ROTC program at the University of Michigan. After pilot training in Pensacola, Florida, and Kingsville, Texas, Chris flew the F-14 Tomcat. Boy, that sounds, I want to hear all kinds of things about it. What a name, great name. And he was in the Fighting Checkmates and the Puking Dogs. Good Lord, I wonder what that's all about. We'll have to ask him. The Puking Dog. Oy, sounds like the first airborne jump. Yeah, a little bit of that. He completed two combat deployments aboard the USS Nimitz to Iraq. And that was in 1995, and aboard the USS John F. Kennedy, we were just talking about that, in Afghanistan in 2012. He is currently the operations officer of the Naval ROTC unit at the University of Michigan. Retired in September of 2011 and transitioned to the University of Michigan staff. Hope you're getting all this, folks. As manager of the Wilson Student Team Project Center in the College of Engineering. Wow, we got to find out all about that. He lives with his wife and children in Dexter, Michigan. And also with me, here he is. That's right. The Captain Harry T. Ridenour, Rear Admiral, U.S. Navy, retired. Harry Ridenour is a native of Ohio. We'll let him have that. That's cool. He graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1968 and was designated a naval aviator in November 1969. Real quick, what did you fly?
I flew A-7s in the Navy and then also a little bit of A-6s on shore, but primarily an A-7, an attack pilot.
So, you know, this guy can walk the talk. He served in a number of air carrier-based attack squadrons, nearly 29 years of active duty service. He accumulated, this was wonderful, 3,000 flight hours, 750 arrested landings. Any of them that you missed the hook?
Oh, sure. You always missed a few of those, but that's why you have an angled deck. You get a chance to come back and do it again.
You kick it again, right.
However, every pass is graded, and so if you miss a wire, your grade goes down. So you're commenting to yourself on what's called the downwind as you're getting ready to come aboard. You're kind of beating your helmet against the canopy rail saying, boy, you know.
And do you have to buy drinks that night?
Not on the ship.
Lord, I got to remember.
Yeah, not on the ship, but after each line period or each at-sea period.
No prune juice or anything like that, eh?
Yeah,
Naval juice, okay.
Yep.
Okay, jungle juice, nothing like that. No, of course not. He, in January 1985, Admiral Ridenour reported to the USS Enterprise, the current one, CVN 65, as the exec officer. He assumed command of the USS Enterprise in October of 1988. And during this tour, Enterprise provided support. Ooh, we want to find out all about this. A special operation during a coup attempt in the Philippines. That was good. I'm glad that we took care of that. And in February 1997, he retired from active duty with the rank of Rear Admiral. And in 1997, Admiral Ridenour joined Perceptron Incorporated. He's Vice President of Quality Assurance. He lives currently in Ann Arbor, Michigan, with his wife and grown children. Gentlemen, after all that wonderful introduction, welcome to Veterans Radio.
It's great to be here.
Oh, it's wonderful. And we pulled it off. We're all in the studio together, and here we are. Well, I've got a ton of questions. The thought of being on a city block, 1,100 feet long?
It's about 1,100 feet long and about 250 feet wide. But, you know, you're going to have a crew assigned to the ship of about 3,000 sailors, and then the air wing, which is a separate component, will bring about 2,500. So you have about 5,500 people on these ships. And if you're out of port for, you know, several days, weeks, months, it's a small home, but it is, in fact, really a city.
Do you get provisioned while you're out?
Sure. You do what's called underway replenishing. And that's where a supply ship will come alongside, and you'll put hoses over the side to replenish fuel. Certainly for a nuclear aircraft carrier, you don't have to worry about fuel for the ship, which is one of the real advantages. That way you can carry more jet fuel and more armament for the aircraft. So you bring aboard fuel, and then you have helicopters, which will be flying between the ships, offloading supplies, food, and it's always good because you may even end up, depending where you are, getting some fresh fruit and vegetables.
I was going to say, you get the fresh strawberries?
Yeah, well, it depends on whether they're in season, but they last probably about a week, and you can tell when they're starting to run out because the lettuce will turn a few colors. It won't be quite as crisp as it used to be.
Yeah, this is Chris. One of the interesting things about the replenishment, I remember on the deployment I made on the Kennedy, the ammunition ship will come along the side at the end of the deployment to take all the ammunition off the ship. And it's amazing. You'll see it pull alongside in the morning at the beginning of the day, and the big red stripe at the bottom of the ammunition ship, the water line, it rides real high in the water. And throughout the day, and this is an all-day-long evolution, and at the end of the day, you can see how that ship is way down, riding low in the water. So you think about this aircraft carrier, you know, 80,000 tons, and it's rising up a little bit, and that ammunition ship is sinking right down as you fill it up.
And that's happening right now, right off the coast of Virginia.
Yeah, I would have to assume that the Enterprise is loading everything off, and it'll go back to that weapons station at Yorktown, just up the coast where they keep all those ammunition. Yeah.
Now, folks, there's very few captains of the Enterprise, and I'm so privileged to have one with me. So I'm going to ask him a lot of mundane stuff. Like, when your ship is being resupplied, where are you?
Well, it's as you can imagine, the ships are about 150 feet apart. So when the ships are in that close proximity, I am looking right out at the window, making sure that the officers who are conning the ship, the alongside conning officers, are paying close attention. Because it doesn't take very much to get into a situation where the ships might touch each other.
Has that ever happened?
Oh, it's happened. In fact, most recently, it happened not with a full-size aircraft carrier, but with the USS Essex off the coast of San Diego, where they had a steering casualty. And that caused the ships to get a little too close, and they actually bumped each other. And fortunately,
I would think that the aircraft carrier would prevail.
Well, fortunately, there were no injuries, and there was an investigation, and as is happens quite frequently, the accountability in the Navy is significant. As the captain of the ship, you're responsible for everything that goes on, and in this case, the captain of the Essex was relieved of his command.
Whoa.
Excuse me, Bob. We've got about a minute and a half till our station break.
Yeah, I guess that they really mean business on this stuff. And even though it may be out of your control, you're still the person on the bridge.
It's direct responsibility and accountability.
And
it goes all the way down. And so, you know, as the captain of a ship, particularly with all these folks on board, you can't really worry about that. You got to trust your crew, trust your training, and then delegate responsibility, because you can't, if you are worried about everything on the ship, then you're not doing your job right.
When you come in after deployment, what is the turnover of the crew?
Depending upon...
How many new guys and gals you
have? Your crew will turn over at least one-third during a turnaround cycle. And that's an awful lot of folks that require retraining. And so,
2,000.
And that's correct. And so as you begin your workups prior to your next deployment, you spend an awful lot of time training, and you really need to walk before you run. But that's what's truly amazing. And I know we're getting close to a little bit of a break here, but the training is really amazing, because the average age of a crew on all Navy ships is between 20 and 21 years old.
Well, I think we can leave it at that and come right back to it. Nina, are we ready for our half break? Good. Take it away, Chauncey.
You're listening to Veterans Radio from our flagship station, WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, and online at AveMaria.net.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife. My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
Thank you.
Well, you know. I know.
That's an Army guy show.
I know. It's just the Halloween gremlins. Yes, I know. And she's looking down. Well, anyway, it's supposed to have been Anchors Away. Well, anyway, that was that's our bump. We're back to our program today on the Big E. No, there's no caissons go rolling. So maybe we can get that on the next break, Nina. We'll do Anchors Away. Well, getting back to our topic today, I have in the studio with me Admiral Harry Ridenour and Commander Christopher Gordon. Christopher is a pilot aboard the Enterprise, and Admiral Ridenour was the captain. So we're getting right back to that on the training. You got 2,000 people to train.
Yeah,
wow.
And
this is on land now.
Well, no. Well, you do some training alongside the pier, but most of your training is done during at-sea periods, which are part of your workups. And these at-sea periods will last anywhere from 2 weeks to a month or so. They get longer as you approach your deployment date. And I think Chris can talk a little bit about it from the air wing standpoint, what's involved there. But what you're doing is you're marrying the ship's capabilities with the air wing's capabilities. And what always continues to amaze me, some of your listeners may know that on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier, considered to be one of the most dangerous working environments in the world today, you have young men and women, as I mentioned earlier, average age of 20 years old. And they have to move this big equipment. And what you see is everyone on the flight deck has responsibilities, and their responsibilities are displayed by the color of the jerseys that they wear. And when you actually have gotten everybody trained, it's almost like an orchestra.
It is.
The air boss is conducting, and he's the air boss is the name of the officer who's in charge of the flight deck.
It's a ballet,
yeah.
And I love to watch some of the crew guys put some of their little personal hitch into that when they're, you know, they're like kicking up a leg and
yeah, the opening of Top Gun, which was shot on Enterprise when I was the
executive. Ooh, there's a little trivia, folks. That's a beer winner.
When I was the executive officer.
Oh, so you were...
I got to watch the shooting
the
of Top.
The filming.
And then we deployed.
Did you meet Tom Cruise?
I did meet Tom Cruise. I won't comment further on that. But the fellow who was the most fun was the air boss, and I've forgotten who he, or not the air boss, but the air wing commander, fellow with
Tom
the bald, the fellow with the bald head. He was probably the most interesting one to talk to. But it was we did all the filming in the early morning hours, at least on the ship, prior to normal flight operations. So it was just part of one of our at sea. pre-deployment periods, but it was a bit of a distraction.
Sure.
And most of us on the ship thought it was going to be, the Top Gun, what is this movie, da-da-da-da-da.
Well, exactly. They're a bunch of amateurs running around on your ship.
And so we left to go on deployment.
And with them?
No, not with them. But, you know, we've completed the shooting, we completed our pre-deployment operations, and we deployed. And so when I come back, I can remember my wife telling me, well, we've got to go see this movie. And I said, well, because when you're deployed back then, you really didn't have satellite hookups or anything like that. So I said, oh, okay, well, what is the movie? She said, Top Gun. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. Did that turn into a good movie? She said, oh, yeah, it's a great movie. And so we went, and it's amazing what film editors can do.
Did you have a cameo in that?
I did not have a cameo in that.
Ah, they left the captain out.
Now the captain at the time had nothing. Didn't have.
Oh.
Well, didn't want anything to do with the movie.
Okay, you're the XO.
So as the XO, he said, make sure this gets done on time,
and they
so
don't
we
fall
can
off.
So nobody gets hurt, so we can proceed with our normal operations. We've got a deployment coming up. But on the other hand, the movie turned out to be a great movie. It's representative of a lot of carrier operations. A lot of great Navy people did have cameo views there or opportunities there. So it was a good show. But getting back to your original point, all the leg kicking and things like that, the people who are probably most animated on the ship are the catapult shooters, the guys that fire the catapults. They're the ones that do all the pointing down
and
the
deck. It is a great recruiting poster. I mean, I'm 70 years old, and I want to join, man, and kick my leg up in the air and send a Tomcat off the end. Speaking of, now here's our pilot, right, Tomcat? What a great name for a fighter. Did you really fly upside down?
Oh, yeah, we did all that stuff, Bob. But it's really the interesting thing that Admiral Ridenour mentioned about leading it off. It's funny because he and I, normally you wouldn't find a fighter and an attack guy sitting in a room together, so it's a little unusual for us to be here. So it's nice to be able to talk about the ship because it's a great experience. And I remember the first catapult launch I ever had as a student pilot. And
your heart was beating.
It is because you just finished your first carrier landing because you fly out to the ship from the shore.
So it's the landing first.
And the landing's first, and you're all by yourself because no flight instructor in his right mind wants to get in the airplane with you on your first carrier landing. So you're flying out there all by yourself on the wing of an instructor pilot. And I remember coming in and you look down at the ship and you think, okay, how in the world am I going to land on that tiny little thing down there in the water? And it's all about the training, like Admiral Ridenour mentioned. And it becomes second nature, you know, all the, you know, power settings and how high you're supposed to be and all the numbers for your airspeed. And you just practice at the shore. And then you come out to the ship and it's supposed to be second nature.
I'm looking at the pilot, folks, and I'm also looking at the captain because just before we did a little, a couple days ago, had a little conversation, the captain and I, and all ships, folks, have idiosyncrasy. They all do. And that's just like something there. And here's the commander coming in to the Enterprise. He knows nothing about the burble. Why don't you tell us about the burble?
So every aircraft carrier, you know, you see a photograph of it, and you appreciate that not only is the flight deck about 65 feet up above the surface of the water, but there's this big island, we call it, which is the superstructure on top of the deck of the aircraft carrier where the captain sits and the air boss sits all up in this elevated spot, and it's covered with antennas. And the Enterprise had a very unique island. It started out its life with this great big cube sitting up on top of there because of some of the radar systems that the ship had. So the shape of the island was different from all the other aircraft carriers in the Navy.
Now that's on the deck.
It's above the flight deck. So that's, you know, when you see a picture of the carrier, it's completely flat, and there's this one part that sticks right up above the rest. And so that's what we call the island. And that island, as you can imagine, when you land on the ship, it's moving through the water, and you'd usually have 20 or 30 knots of wind blowing across the deck. And so this great big island is like a big windbreak. And the air swirls around the island, and it comes back to the back of the ship, and then it drops off down toward the water from that 65 feet
high. Like a rooster tail.
Exactly. So there's a little ways back behind the ship, there's this rooster tail where that air kicks up. So as a pilot, you're flying down to make your landing, and you hit the rooster tail, you get this little push up, and the airplane wants to climb, so you reduce the power a little bit to keep on
Did
the right glide
slope. Did you know that coming in?
Well, you know it's there, but you don't have any way to know exactly where it is or how strong it's going to be. And so we all knew with the Enterprise there was this lore that the burble was crazy because of this great big island that the ship had. So you fly through the rooster tail, your power's back a little bit, and you're trying to stay on the right glide slope, and then you hit the burble, which is the air dropping off the back of the ship, and then the airplane wants to sink right down toward the water. So you've got to add the power back on, and so it can be a little exciting. So I remember the first time I went out to land on the Enterprise, there was a lot of anticipation of, okay, how bad is this burble going to be out here? But you get some experience and you learn how to compensate for that. But
you caught the wire the first time.
Yes. So I look back in my logbook.
Was it a hard landing?
So no, every carrier landing is a hard landing. That's the intention. So, and I still fly today a little bit, so everybody's always nervous going to fly with me. They think I'm going to break the airplane, you know, because I'm a carrier pilot. But so, they don't all have to be that way. But at the ship, they're all pretty pretty firm.
And it's that way because you have to sort of drop on the carrier once you're
well,
at that spot.
That's right. So the idea is you fly basically a constant glide path all the way down to land. So, you know, the listeners, they're used to flying on the airlines. You come in and land, and the pilot will kind of cushion the landing a little bit, and it lengthens the distance of the landing by doing that. So, you know, on the aircraft carrier, those four wires are spaced out in the span of only a couple hundred feet. So what you've got to do is you've got to plant the airplane in that exact spot to make sure that the tail hook catches one of those four wires across the flight deck. So there's not a big margin for error. And as Admiral Rittenour mentioned, as soon as you touch down, you just automatically go to full power, and you're waiting for that reassuring tug that the wire caught. And otherwise, you just bounce right through and you go back around and try again as you're kicking yourself flying on downwind for why you missed.
Were your legs a little wobbly that first time when you got out of that cockpit?
No, in the daytime, there's not a whole lot of wobbly legs. It's just a lot of fun. But at nighttime, I think it's chronic wobbly leg syndrome. When you get out of the airplane at nighttime, you're just glad to be alive because it's a big challenge.
Oh, we're going to talk about that in just a moment. I want to go back to the Admiral, who was skipper as well as the EO, executive officer of the Enterprise. And what did you think? See, I mean, here comes a cherry pilot coming in and saying, oh, gosh, here we go. And was it that way, or what did you feel looking up there? How many stories up were you?
Well, you're about 10 stories above the flight deck.
How far is that?
Well, the top of Enterprise is about 180 feet above the waterline. So you're probably 60 feet above the deck. But as Chris pointed out, you really are well trained when you come out to the ship. And I can remember my first carrier landings, and I was so pumped up that they were over. You usually got 4 to 5. They were over before you knew it. And that's just because you were so well trained. The other aspect about it is that there's a person on the end of the carrier called the landing signal officer, the LSO. And that's the person who's responsible for safely bringing an aircraft aboard the carrier.
Let me just, is this the guy who had the paddles way back in World War II?
In World War II, that would be the paddles guy, the lighted paddles.
Yeah.
And they would go up if you were a little high, down like this, and they would give you the cut. Well, jet engines, as Chris, or a jet aircraft, as Chris pointed out, don't take a cut. You go to full power whenever you land because you need to be ready to go around again if you miss a wire. But to your point, we would do carrier refresher training for the FRS, the Fleet Replacement Squadron. Those are the new guys that are coming out. And they're so well trained. You try to give them the best landing conditions that you can. The angle on the carrier is offset the landing area by about 10 degrees. And it's the ship's responsibility to make sure that the wind is coming down the angled deck. So as the captain, that's when you have new folks out there, that's one of the most important things that you can do is make sure the wind is set up right so these guys and gals have the best chance that they can. So they can get aboard safely.
Well, we're coming up on a break. Wow, this time is really flying. Okay, Chauncey, take it.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Yeah, we got it that time. Anchors away. Wow. You guys could stay here for hours, and I just love this stuff. I love it. I think in another life I was an aircraft. What do they call aircraft? I mean, you have submariners and tin can guys and gals. What do they call aircraft carriers? Do they have any?
They just call them carriers. And
The people that work there, there's just no.
Ships are generally thought to be big things, but the carrier by aviators in particular is called the boat. And when you're going out somewhere, when you're going out to sea, you're going to go, yeah, we're going out to the boat. Now, submariners call their ships boats, but everyone else calls a ship a ship. But aviators call the carrier the boat.
Okay, I'm looking over here at Commander Chris Gordon. He's shaking his head. Tell us about that.
It is. It's the boat, and that's what we call it. And I don't think the guys that work on the ship really appreciate that. And there is. It's interesting, this relationship between the ship and the air wing. You know, when you first come out and the first time you're on the boat and you're getting ready for this deployment, you definitely have the feeling that we're two different groups. You got the Airedales and all the squadron people.
Airedales.
And then you've got the ship's company, the crew of the ship. And so it feels like we're guests. And by the time you're ready to deploy, you really work as a team, and that's what that period of training is all about.
As we talked this morning, when we had our meeting, and I wanted to clarify this. If you ever look, folks, at aircraft carrier takeoffs, and you see it on film, whatever, you see it on the military channel, notice the right hand is up on something. Well, why don't you tell us about that, Commander?
Yeah, so
that's a monkey grip, did you say?
Well, they call it the towel bar, but that's specific to to one airplane on the aircraft carrier. That's the F-18 Hornet, which is the latest generation of a strike fighter that flies there on the ship, and it has this automatic flight control system. So when you're getting ready to take off, Everett mentioned the shooter, the catapult officer. So you pull up on the catapult and you do your final checks. And then when you're actually ready to take off, they put the catapult into tension, it's called, which is where it's kind of like cocking the gun. It's cocked and ready to go. And as a pilot in the airplane, that's your signal. You go up to full power on the engines with your left hand in the throttles. And then with your right hand, you take the control stick and you wipe it out. So you kind of stir it around in the cockpit to make sure all the flight controls are working properly. And you've got two sailors from the squadron, the final checkers, are out there watching the airplane on the catapult to make sure all the controls are moving the right way.
Now, let's get this. You've just kicked it full throttle. You have your feet on the brakes, right?
No, your feet are not on the brakes, because your feet are on the rudder pedals, because you're moving the rudders back and forth. And then the last thing you want to do is touch the brakes, because if your feet are on the brakes when that catapult fires, both tires will blow in an instant. So you're checking all the flight controls, and you're at full power, but the catapult, there's a hold back fitting, it's called, and that's what holds the airplane back until the catapult fires.
Now, is it shaky?
Oh, the airplane, yeah, it's making a ton of noise, and it's shaking and jiggling, and it's like in anticipation of going off the end of the ship. And so you do this whole control wipeout, you check everything, and when you're happy inside the cockpit that everything's ready, then you turn and you look at the catapult officer and you salute him. So that's with your right hand.
It's a salute, not
and
a thumbs
no,
up.
No, it's a salute. It's a very clear
signal. Is
that
tradition?
And I think it's tradition, yeah, and at nighttime you turn your lights on the airplane. That means because you can't see
the captain right now, folks, is shaking his head. Yes, and giving thumbs up, so that's tradition. Now, here's this Tomcat pilot, and he's got the throttle full going. And on a Tomcat, though, you can have your hand on the stick.
That's right. So in the F-18 with this automatic flight control system, the pilot will salute, and then he grabs a hold of that handle up on the windshield, the windscreen there, and he holds that all the way. Because if he touches the control stick while the airplane's going down the catapult, that automatic flight control system is going to move the controls in the opposite direction. So he's got to keep his hand off.
Now, that's another beer winner, folks. So look for that.
That's
when you
right.
see the military. military channel. Look for that. Okay, I interrupt you, but I wanted to get that in.
In the F-14, we just put our hand kind of down in our lap, and the stick would gradually work. The control stick would come back into your hand. So when you got to the end of the catapult, you kind of this little bit of a jar when you reach the end, and you grab a hold of the control stick, and you roll the airplane a little bit one way or the other, called a clearing turn, and then you set yourself on course to fly.
So while this thing is shaking, making a whole bunch of noise, you've got maybe your right hand up. What are you thinking about, your pension or your wife or
your
laundry is ready or what?
No, that's it. What you're very focused on, concentrating on the instruments in the airplane to make sure that the engines are still functioning the way they should. And it's really sort of a tunnel vision moment where you're waiting for that catapult to fire and the acceleration. And in the F-14, the maximum weight we take off at on the carrier was about 70,000 pounds. So the airplane, it's a pretty good kick in the pants when that catapult fires.
Does it slam you to the...
It doesn't slam you back because it's a sort of a gradual acceleration. That's the steam-powered catapult.
Oh, okay.
So it's this expansion along the distance of the catapult stroke. So it's not a real solid slam. But when you get to the end, you feel a pretty good thunk when before you launch up into the air.
Well, Admiral, you have something to say about that?
No, that's a... Chris gave a very good... explanation of a cat shot. And I think one of the differences between a cat shot and a landing, the pilot has a lot more control over the landing. The catapult, you have no control over it. Once the catapult fires, you're going down the cat track. And, I mean, there's so much energy in that if things aren't right, that's why Chris mentioned you want to make sure that you're very focused to make sure you haven't missed anything in the cockpit. But once that catapult fires, you're going. And it doesn't make any difference whether your brakes are on or whether they're off. You're going down. And
that's it. The point of no return.
Yeah, and I had a squadron CO when I was a junior officer flying that said, you know, a night catapult shot is like an E-ride at Disneyland. You put your quarter in the map case. And it goes, and you don't have any control over it at all.
That's right. And it really goes to, this is Chris again, what Admiral Ritenour said earlier about trust and responsibility. And you're sitting there in the cockpit, and you realize that there are all of these people around you in all these different colored jerseys that Admiral Ritenour mentioned.
Kicking their leg up in the air.
They are. They all have their job to do. And I remember, you know, it doesn't matter how many hours you have on the ship. When you make that salute on the catapult, and you get yourself ready to go, you look out the corner of your eye, and in the newer ships, it's called the bubble. It's an area up by the catapult where the actual person who activates the catapult is sitting.
What's he looking for, or she?
Well, what they're looking for is that catapult officer. Once he's happy, you've saluted him, he does one final look at all the people on the flight deck, are giving him a thumbs up that they think the airplane's ready to go, and then he's going to bend down and touch the deck and point toward the bow. And that's the signal for the actual launch and recovery equipment sailor who is going to look and check the pressure one more time, and then he pushes the button. And on the older ships, on the side of the ship in the bow, the pilot can see out of the corner of his eye, there's a sailor who has his hands up in the air, standing in the catwalk on the side of the ship. And when the catapult officer touches the deck, you can see out of the corner of your eye, that right hand will disappear down, and it pushes the button. So you know when the catapult pulse going. But it's all about trust. It's all about trust on the carrier.
And, Admiral, when you're the captain, of course, you're up there in the bridge. Are you up there for night takeoffs and landings? Are you also
You're up there for every takeoff and landing. Now, I qualify because when you're deployed, you do some very long hours. So I qualified two other officers as command duty officers underway. It's called a CDO underway qualification. So the navigator, who is also an aviation, and I guess I might mention for your listeners that it's U.S. code law that the captain and the executive officer of an aircraft carrier have to be an aviation officer. So that's why
you have to fly.
Well, you have to have that flying experience because, as Chris points out, it's all about trust. You have to have gone through the experience so you understand how important it is to get things right. And so you're up there because it's your responsibility. So you're up there watching all the catapult launches and all the landings, unless one of your certified and qualified officers is in the chair. but you're up there for a majority of them.
Well, folks, Chauncey, about a minute and a half? Okay, well, is that to where I sort of bail out, right?
That's until we're going to play Eternal Father.
Okay, wow, this has just got a few moments. All right, Commander, would you, both you gentlemen, please come back. Let's do another aircraft carrier program where we're just going to sit down and talk about this. And do you have any final 15 seconds that you want to say, Commander?
No, it's a pleasure to be here. Like I said, it's fun to be
Isn't
here with
fun?
Them. We're now looking at this from our two different perspectives on the ship, and it's been great to be here. Thanks.
Oh, I want to go into that more in our next program. Admiral, thank you very much. You got out of I-94. You made it here. Is there anything, you got about 15 seconds that you'd like to say?
I'd like to thank Chris for being here. I'd like to thank you, and I guess the... it's getting to be that time of the year, so as an Academy guy, I got to say, go Navy, beat Army.
Okay, Nina, what do I got right now? We don't have a countdown clock, folks. 10 seconds, very quickly, next week, it's going to be a salute to the Marines. That's right, it's their birthday. And there we go. And it is Veterans Day, so give us a call. And if you are a Marine, 877-573-7825. Until that time, you are dismissed.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.